This programme was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi te motu, MPR. If you're enjoying this podcast in Manawatu, you could make your very own, just like this one. MPR exists to help people like you tell your story or share your passion on air and online. Check out mpr.nz for more information.
It's time for our Monday Serial, a respectable veneer written by Rachel Doré, published by Upstart Press and narrated by Romy Hooper. This serial has been made possible by funding from the Earl Creativity and Development Trust with collaboration from Manawatu People's Radio. A Respectable Veneer is a story about love and courage, but we remind you of our regular content warning. There are elements of violence and references to child abuse.
Last week, Ruby's nerves were stretched when she had to deal with young Edie seeming conscious in bed with a fever, at which coincided with one of Frank's crippling health episodes. Ruby has begun to wonder whether she's up to coping with Frank's periodic deliriums and disturbing nightmares.
She hadn't meant to fall asleep. The sunroom was warm when she'd sat on the comfortable little chair to tack stitch in the sleeves of Edie's new coat, and she'd blinked. That was all. Now the light was pale and sunless. The cherry red coat had slipped to the floor beside her, the threaded needle with it. She must have slept more than an hour. Aching with love, Ruby touched Edie's forehead. Edie, please, please get better. The barely audible syllable Edie uttered stung Ruby's eyes, but no tears came. In the kitchen, Douglas was reading the paper.
Oh, good, he said, folding the pages when he saw her. I looked in on our Frank, still out for the count. How's our Edie?
Much the same. She wanted his arms around her, anyone's arms. She wished Janice was sitting there instead of him. Janice would hug her, hold her, comfort her and cheer her up. Yes, I peeked in on Frank, she said. He hadn't stirred.
No, he wouldn't have, he said. Bradshaw's shot always sends him off for a good while.
The kettle was empty. He'd made himself a pot of tea. I'm going to make Edie a lemon and honey drink. It might help. I don't suppose you know if there's a lemon squeezer somewhere?
Haven't seen one.
She tried not to clang things about in cupboards and drawers.
Ruby, I hope you don't mind. I don't mean to interfere.
Honestly, Douglas, out with it.
I brought along some Foxton Fizz for our Edie. Creaming soda. Might be a bit more drinkable than warm water for a change. You could put lemon in it if you like.
You really are sweet, thank you. She kissed his cheek and he blushed. It'll be good for her after the nastiest medicine. He grinned, watching her pour a glass.
My pleasure. Have some yourself. I brought along a dozen bottles. Frank likes it too.
Capital, she said.
By the way, I almost forgot. I've also bought her a book for when she's better.
She's asleep now. Janice bought some comics.
Ah, but this is Cole's funny picture book.
He looked pleased with himself. I know the one, said Ruby. She'll love it, thanks.
I might hang about for a bit. You don't mind, do you? Say, how do you fancy sharing fish and chips tonight? I don't suppose Edie will be up to it.
Thanks. Edie's too ill.
There's not much I can do for Frank for quite a while, he said. I'll pop out now.
I'll get my purse. Douglas raised his palm.
My treat. Please. Beckon a tick. There's never a queue on a Thursday.
If she was alone, she wouldn't bother eating. After giving Edie her medicine and a drink, she put her clean cardigan over the grey dress for warmth. It didn't matter that the wristbands were still a little damp. She looked in the mirror. The hideous grey frock didn't look so bad with the black cardigan.
We shouldn't bother with plates and things, Douglas said when he arrived with the newspaper parcel of fish and chips. Let's pretend we're camping out and eat it out of the paper with our fingers.
They ate in silence. He, using his thumb and forefinger, prized the batter off first in small pieces, followed by flakes of flesh, which he popped cleanly into his mouth. The fish was tender, the batter perfectly crisp. When they had finished, Douglas rolled up the grease-stained paper, then leaned back in his chair.
That's the best way to eat fish and chips, he said contentedly.
Ruby rubbed her stomach. Oh, I ate too much. There are some cakes here if you'd like one. Janice brought them. He lifted the lid of the cake box.
Frank might like the fly cemetery later on.
What about you? She said.
Me? I...
Douglas, she said in a mock command. Have a cake. Have two. There's no use them going stale. I doubt Edie will be up to one tomorrow. When she's a bit better, I might make her some custard.
Custard? Frank would give you his right arm for custard.
Delight filled his face.
I'll give you some thruppences for the extra milk. There should be an extra quart bottle under the sink. I'll even put the bottles out for you.
All right, Ruby said. I'll get rid of the paper. The greasy paper was in her hand. She switched on the porch light. Her fingers stretched across the smudged print. The light caught a word she recognized as the bundle dropped into the rubbish tin. She stooped to read the full headline. Grizzly discovery in Freeman's Bay. Ruby lowered herself onto the edge of the cold step and spread the wrinkled paper out flat. Somehow this page of the Auckland Star had made its way to a Palmerston North fish and chip shop, and now her eyes were devouring the story under the headline. This morning's discovery of the bludgeoned and mutilated body of a woman has halted demolition work clearing condemned derelict houses in Freeman's Bay. Workmen found the body at 8 o'clock this morning and notified police. The murdered woman was a known prostitute, identified by police as a Cook Islander, Hualani Henry, also known as Angel Henry, aged 30. One of the workmen. A dark fog drifted over Ruby's eyes. She made out the words she didn't want to see, words she had to read. Quirk Street House, burns, extensive pelvic injuries, officers of the Criminal Investigation Branch coroner, pathologist. The contents of her stomach soured and churned. She crossed the porch to the lavatory and vomited. By the date at the top of the page, the body must have been found a week after Ruby walked into Salon Vardo. There was no doubt about why Angel had been killed. Her death would not have been easy. Lou Watkins. But Ruby had as good as murdered Angel herself. While she was getting to know Douglas and Janice, beginning to find her feet, Angel was... Her mouth opened wide, teeth bared in a soundless scream as she began tearing up the sheet with its vile news, pulling it, using her fingernails to shred it with hot hatred. Pieces of newspaper fluttered out past the porch, down the step and onto the path, spreading its foulness. The sound of Douglas filling the kettle and clanking about behind the kitchen door pulled her back to herself. He mustn't open the door and see her now. Numbly, she gathered up the inky, grease-stained litter and wrapped it tightly in the largest remaining piece. With a last look at the parcel in the bottom of the rubbish tin, she jammed the lid on. Over the washtub, she scrubbed her ink-blackened hands again and again until her skin burned.
"Tea's brewed,"
called Douglas. He was sitting leaning back, his legs crossed, screened by the Manawatu Evening Standard as he read. "I wonder," she said, "would Frank mind, do you think, if I had a little whiskey instead?" He rattled his paper and raised his head.
"What? Did you say whiskey? Are you sure you wouldn't prefer brandy? He won't mind. It's sort of mine, actually. Won it in a raffle at a conference last year. I'll join you."
From head to toe, her body was as empty as the brandy bowl in her hand. Now a ball of sickly warmth sat where her stomach should be. Douglas was speaking. He had a pleasant voice, properly rounded vowels. She'd noticed that the minute she met him. She had no idea what he'd been saying behind the screen of newspaper. "Please, will you stay? The night?" she stammered. He folded his paper and sat forward.
"To tell the truth, I was working my way up to asking you that very thing. I wasn't."
"Please do. With Edie's fever and Frank..." Ruby brushed her hand over her hair. "I'm just not sure what to do for him."
"There isn't an alternative," he said. "You know I'll see to Frank. He may be coming around soon."
"Will he want anything? Should I make something? Honestly, I'm afraid I might be out of my depth with him."
"Don't worry about it," said Douglas. "He won't want much, and he can be finicky. I'll get him whatever he needs. Has he had any nightmares? They can be a bit startling."
"Not that I know of."
Can you see why I wanted you here?"
"Yes. If Edie wasn't sick as well..."
"He'll be himself, once he slept it all off."
This assessment didn't help.
"Please, don't worry," Douglas said. "Old Bradshaw's stuff works wonders. You'll see. And I see he's given him a new lot of pills. A little stronger than before, I think."
"Can't you stay the whole weekend?" Panic crossed his face and his jaw twitched. She saw he was on the verge of stammering again. "Look," she cut in before he could speak. "People will hardly notice you're here at all for a few days, and even if they do, I'll be a Jezebel for bewitching you into it. They might tut-tut with moral outrage, I suppose, and that'll be it." He scuffed his foot, morosely pensive.
You've got a point."
"Honestly, Douglas, nothing will happen. It wouldn't reflect on you and Frank in any way." He twisted his mouth. "Besides," Ruby pressed, "how do people know you and I aren't seeing each other? Couples do that sort of thing these days. Will anybody care?"
"Dash it all. You're right."
He leaned back and put his feet on the other chair.
"My dear Ruby, forgive me. This sort of thing is new territory to me. I could stay till Monday."
"If you mean it, would you mind terribly lending a hand with a couple of things around the place?"
"You direct me and I'll do anything you tell me to do."
She'd hoped the second brandy would help her sleep. Asking for one of Frank's pills had been tempting. She had more compassion than ever for the girls she knew whose only respite was an opium house. Every time she shut her eyes, she saw Angel. She could smell her. Her hands remembered the satiny warmth of Angel's breasts, the copper-brown areolae, and the marvel of her cushiony body with its dark folds. angel filled the room. Dear, kind, gentle angel. Angel who sang to Edie with a voice that sounded like the lapping of waves on sand. Angel. Whatever mechanism that ought to trigger the flow of watery tears had been broken in her long ago. There was no weeping. Self-vilification squatted on her chest like a monstrous goblin, pinning her down, pointing its bony finger in her face. Lou Watkins had broken Angel, hadn't he? Had she told Angel about Palmerston North? She couldn't remember. Is that why he was down here? Or was it happenstance? Whatever was behind it, there was no mistake. He was in town, and he'd be looking for them. Edie's forehead was still warmer than it should be. She draped a spare blanket over her shoulders and tiptoed past the closed door where the men slept, to Frank's parlour. The air had the stuffy odour of a room which needed using. The blinds looked as though they had not been touched since the late Mrs. Pierce drew them halfway down, before she caught that train. Ruby tugged a tasseled blind pull. The roller flicked and rattled, spinning the blind to the top. She caught her breath, listening. The noise hadn't disturbed the men. When Frank had first shown her the house, she'd hardly glanced into the room. Switching the light on, she looked around. A Chesterfield suite took up most of the room, and bookcases and shelves full of books lined the walls. The top of a piano was the only surface clear of the clutter of ornaments. A Bechstein. Her fingers flexed. It was a long time since she'd had the chance to play. The lid was locked. She might ask Frank about it one day. Edie should have music lessons. Perhaps he'd locked the piano up, grieving for his mother. There had to be a family medical book, like the one her parents had. On a shelf of encyclopedias and dictionaries, including one about learning to speak Esperanto, she found a 2-volume recent edition of Caxton's Family Physician. The doctor had told her to phone him if she saw any signs of a rash. What sort of rash, he didn't say. According to the medical book, signs of a rash could mean severe complications. She flew back to Edie's bed to unbutton her pajama top and found Edie's thin chest as unblemished as ever. She sat on the side of the bed, clutching the Caxton, watching Edie breathe. Everything she could do was done. Edie must recover. Replacing the tome, she took another look around. The room was in bad need of dusting. What had Vi actually done? A couple of fine-quality Dresden figurines sat on each side of a shell-covered box. On a side table, a vase of faded roses bowed their dead heads. A large photograph on the wall showed Frank and Douglas in outlandish vaudeville costumes, their wide smiles and laughing eyes frozen in the wooden frame. It pained her to look at the young duo, posed in a dance position. Frank was half a head taller. Both were debonair, full of hopes for success in what they thought was their future. The photograph on the wall of a narrow-waisted young woman, swathed in drapery and holding a Grecian urn, had to be of Frank's mother. Her mouth open, in a moment of delivering a dramatic line of a play. Frank had certainly inherited her good looks. In a smaller photo, Mrs. Pierce's eyebrows were plucked and arched, dark curls artfully combed forward over her cheeks, and bee-sting lips painted on her mouth. The lopsided smile made her look as though she was holding back naughty laughter. There was the same mischief in the dark eyes that Ruby had seen in Frank's. There was also kindliness, humour, and toughness. "What do you think, Mrs. Pierce?" she whispered. "Can we cope with all this?" Throughout the remaining hours of darkness, Ruby concentrated on putting the finishing touches to Edie's new coat. When the sky lightened, she lifted Edie's head for another spoonful of medicine.
is Janice here? Edie croaked.
That was yesterday. She came to see you. She's gone now. Edie may not have heard. Ruby cradled her back onto the pillow and went to the kitchen to make herself a cup of tea. Ruby got out of bed with plans for the day. Among the wind-dried garments in the washing basket waiting to be put away was a folded pair of dark grey herringbone trousers that Ruby had found the previous morning. They were made of stout wool and must have belonged to someone shorter than Frank. In a drawer, she found a man's oatmeal knitted jersey with holes in the elbows that had been darned well enough. Knowing the late Mrs. Pierce's reluctance to throw things out, they may have belonged to Frank's father. A pair of knitted socks that had been expertly darned would do as slippers. Now that the smell of mothballs had been washed out of these things, she was glad to get into them. She tied the green silk scarf around her neck for effect and decided to put on some lipstick. The coarse wool of the pants irritated her inner thighs before she'd taken a step away from the wardrobe mirror. If men got used to it, so would she. What would Frank say when he saw her in his father's old clothes? She didn't care. She was warm. She grinned at herself. Angel would laugh and approve. The sky was the colour of pearls, and the yard was silvered with frost when she brought in the icy milk bottles. She made herself another pot of tea and listened for sounds of movement in the house. Silence had a peculiar frequency, like a soundless noise. Douglas's presence was a catalyst that altered everything. It was both strange and comforting. A new, unfamiliar warmth soaked her heart. Perhaps it was just the sturdy, warm clothes. Ruby dragged the fireside rug out of the dining room and hoisted it over the washing line.
"Good Lord," Douglas said when he saw what she was doing. "I thought someone was driving through the place in a tank."
"Sorry, I didn't think." She hadn't dared give in to any thought. "How's Frank? Have you had breakfast? What would you like?"
"Frank's a bit better. He'll rest for the day." "No, I haven't had breakfast. And if we've got enough eggs, I might make an omelette. Would you like one?" "Tell you what, I'll make a nice large one and you can have some."
He wandered off down the yard, peering among the frost-bruised weeds, mumbling about chives. By late afternoon, Frank made his way to the kitchen with a meandering sort of shuffle, leaning shakily on his cane. He looked gaunt, his eyes luminescent obsidian, deep in their sockets.
"Good Lord!"
His eyebrows rose when he saw her.
"Look at you! Whatever you're dressed as, it suits you. I think I like you better. But other than looking wonderful, you're looking bloody awful. Bad night?"
She gave him a grin and made him some sweet tea.
"Where's Tink?"
he asked. "In bed with a fever." She couldn't be sure he remembered anything of the day before. "I went into the front room and borrowed the medical books."
"Did you call Bradshaw?"
"I did. She's got two bottles of medicine to take."
"Is she better?"
"The doctor said she has to rest. I'm about to go in."
"Bradshaw, rest and dope. That's the thing."
You've been listening to A Respectable Veneer, a serialized novel by Rachel Doré, read by Romy Hooper. Listen to the next episode at 8 p.m. next Monday, or for the rest of the series, go to npr.nz/show/respectableveneer, or search for A Respectable Veneer wherever you find your podcasts.
If you enjoy this NPR podcast, please consider subscribing. Our podcasts are available on all major podcasting platforms: Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, as well as the accessmedia.nz app. Support this show and and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.mpr.nz/donate.